Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, this is Bruce Norris. Thank you for joining us. We're very privileged to have for the next 2 weeks, Gary Watts. Gary Watts is the owner of Impact Real Estate. He's a broker owner, and he's an economist. He's probably the most recognized forecasting expert in California. Gary, we welcome you to our show.
Well, thank you, Bruce.
Gary, how long have you been forecasting what's going to go on in California?
This is, I think, the 34th year. I'm an old guy.
Well, you certain, that takes a lot of guts, too. It does. Forecasting does, especially, I've noticed on the internet, whenever you make a forecast and the bloggers get a hold of it, they have a good memory for anything that may not be completely accurate, and that's unfortunate in a way.
Well, I had a good string up until about a year and a half ago.
Yeah, you did. There's no doubt about that. So, yeah, everybody should be remembering some of the years that you were really diametrically opposed to everyone else, and you were the ones that were saying it was still going to go up, and it, in fact, it did. What did surprise you, say, in 2007?
Well, of course, we were doing fairly well, despite the subprime problems that occurred, in 2006. We were still holding our own until the financial market panicked. And that overreaction in the financial market and then shutting down all types of various financing, as well as putting a premium on jumbo loans, completely shut down both the low end, put the brakes on the low end and then caused the high end to really slow down.
You know, it's interesting. You have a degree in economics, and then you also have advanced studies in psychology.
Right.
There's a lot of psychology that goes into what happens in the real estate market.
Absolutely. And, and I think that one of the things is, of course, you well know, it's we've had a huge media-driven, negativity in the marketplace. And as long as that exists, it's going to keep a lid on the buyers coming back into the marketplace.
Let's talk about the lending practices that sort of got us into this mess. What was different about the way loans were funded during the recent boom versus prior years? How did we end up with this situation?
Well, you can look at it two ways. Number one is that we brought in a lot of buyers through what we call the subprime. That would have never been able to get in. And I think it's, for your listeners, it's important to understand something. And that is that the subprime market, the true subprime, is only 6% of the entire loan business. If you do the Alt-A, a little better than subprime, but less than prime, it makes up 13. So 87% of our market is a solid lending market. It was only this 6 to 13%, however you want to measure it, that was subprime. And the new numbers aren't out for the final fourth quarter in terms of just delinquencies. But in the third quarter, these subprime people, these people that never dreamed they could own a home, still 86% of them hadn't missed a house payment. 86%. And I think the reason is they never dreamed they would own a home. I think they kind of had it in their mind they would be tenants forever. And once these special financing was offered, and they went with just stated loans, no verifications of things. I think that those people that got in there, made it to the big top. They entered the big leagues, and I think they just don't want to give it up. They'll work one or two jobs before they let their house go.
Well, there is a psychological difference between owning and renting. That's a better conversation. Where do you live? I own this. That is a better conversation.
Absolutely.
And in some cultures, it's actually huge. I didn't understand that. I have a friend that's Cuban-born, and he explained to me the significance of owning versus renting. In that culture, it's a very big deal.
You've been around a long time. I remember when the boat people in the 70s, mm-hmm. we came over here, we put them in rental units, and within 10 years, they worked two or three jobs, learned the language, and bought their first house. Any place else in the world, a house is like a status symbol. And it means a lot to the family and to the honor of that family. And so they will. They'll work very hard to keep a hold on it.
During those years where subprime was really operating, I wanted to go over a typical transaction and just, first of all, find out if this person would have been able to buy. I just put a hypothetical example together.
Go right ahead.
Somebody with a 580 FICO score, $10,000 in the bank, and a desire to own a $600,000 property. Was that purchase possible in, let's say, 2005?
Barely. It probably wasn't.
Okay. What would
Actually, at the end of from the summer of 2005 on, it probably was.
Okay.
But prior to that time period, no.
Okay. At the easiest, though, it probably was.
Correct.
Okay. Is that where we got in trouble, where we really just started letting almost every case go through?
You could say that.
Okay.
You really couldn't. But people need to understand that the lenders were making so much money. I mean, the interesting thing about the subprime market is there's two divisions. There's the fixed and the adjustable. Now, the adjustable is the larger size, but of the subprime, of that 6.5%, only 4% was adjustable. And yet it's 43% of our foreclosure problem. So that's an amazing number. The subprime fixed market is still doing fairly well. And these rates were, you know, both in the adjustable, what the lenders, the money people assumed they might receive, and with the subprime fixed, these East Coast banks were making a fortune, and they didn't care that they were going below 600 on FICO scores. Well, and they even went to their underwriters and said, hey, you know what, their actuary tables, how much can we lose? And they estimated that maybe as much as 7%. But their portfolios were yielding 9 to 10%. And so they kept pumping the money in.
Well, now, they also were passing on the risk, correct?
I mean, oh, absolutely.
They were putting all this product in mortgage-backed securities and CDOs and so forth.
Exactly.
And they moved it on. Had that ever been done before? Had we ever funded loans in that manner before, where we could off the risk and then just reload the boat?
Not really.
Okay.
They came up with, like you said, collateralized debt obligations and then the structured investment vehicles. Those were two new things that orchestrated the subprime. They repackaged them as really high-quality instruments and then sold them off around the world.
Now, it's interesting because that sounds funny to you and me, because we understand the structure of one subprime loan, where that could have been 100% loan-to-value with somebody stating income that may be inaccurate with a low FICO score. And if you ever invested in trustees, I mean, we fund trustees all the time, and in this market, we're pretty hesitant to go past 65%, and they were rating these AAA when they were 100%.
Yes, but you know how they were able to rate them as AAA is the whole package didn't contain just subprime.
Correct.
It had a variety of loans, business loans, leasing contracts. I mean, it encompassed, you know, plus the regular prime financing. So it was a huge myriad of different instruments, and that was one of the problems when they sold them off to the investors. The investors really never knew what percentages all these broke down. So when they heard that the U.S. had a big subprime market, they said, oh, my God, we have subprime instruments. They didn't know how much, but their overreaction was, shoot, then we're not making any more loans. And then the money went away.
Well, you know, when real estate goes up at a 15 or 20% per year clip, it pretty much covers all sins. So these people that maybe shouldn't have gotten loans were bailed out by either having equity to refi, equity to resell. But if you have a stake in it, you're probably going to keep that payment current. And I think that's the biggest problem. Now, the statistics that you just quoted about the percentages or the overall pile of loans,
right?
They hold a different percentage if you're talking about those years, let's say, of 2004 and 2005. Is that probably true?
Oh, yes. In those 2004, 2005, and into the first quarter of 2006, you averaged almost 24 to 28, depending on which state, percent of subprime loans.
In comparison to that, let's say to the FHA and VA program, the subprime dwarfed both of those in total. Wouldn't that be true?
During that time period, absolutely.
Yeah, during that time period, because they basically were the replacement for the FHA loan program.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the combined loans of FHA and VA, they only represented 9%. They represent today 9% of the market.
Of the total that's existing?
Correct.
Okay.
Total existing. But you're right. When FHA had the, you know, would not raise the conforming loan limit, especially here in the state of California, subprime took over that FHA.
Yeah, I'm really glad to see the change. I hope the change is permanent. I think that would probably be a huge help to end the temptation to get stated income and adjustable products. I really do.
Yeah.
I think it's going to hurt the median price, though, because I really think we're going to have to figure out what people really do qualify for. But, you know, I think that's actually long-term it's healthier for California than we go through it.
I agree with you on that. And that's the problem is that, you know, in speaking to the real estate industry, and that's the only people that I speak to, you know, my first question is, you know, how many of you are dealing with a qualified buyer who's waiting to buy? And the hands shoot up.
Mm-hmm.
So the pent-up demand is out there. What we're waiting for is exactly what you're referring to. Number one, how are the lenders going to qualify the new buyers? And right now, no one really knows. I was in a meeting with the a senior VP of Bank of America, and he says, we're going to be introducing a layered structure. You know, if you've got 20% down and you've got long-term employment and you've got a great credit score, you get our best rate. And then it tears down from there. But it's not going to be a simple, you know, throw you in a pot and everybody gets one number anymore.
Okay. It's almost like they tranche their own business.
Exactly.
Okay. When you say pent-up demand, I mean, I just have a trouble understanding how that could be true, only in the sense that we seem to let everyone in that could fog a mirror in 05 and the first part of 06. Who wouldn't have been the buyer? I almost think we borrowed into the future buyers that wouldn't have matured, and we crammed them into 05 and 06. But you feel that that's not true?
Well, there are two parts to it now. Number one is, yes, we definitely sucked with the subprime a lot of tenants who never would have bought into the marketplace. And, again, going back to the psychology side, when everybody's jumping in and houses are going up, you know, $10,000 every month, it did force a lot of people to either borrow or figure out, hey, we better move in earlier rather than later. So you're correct on that side. Now, my speaking is pretty much in Southern California, although I was up in the Bay Area not long ago. And so I'm really talking about some of the, I guess, what do I say? My speaking is, when I say pent-up demand, it's limited. It's into, you know, the Orange County market where there's a pent-up demand, the Bay Area where there's a growing pent-up demand. I can't speak for the Central Valley where it's got a ton of problems, mm-hmm. you know, the Inland Empire, and, of course, the Sacramento Delta area.
Is the pent-up demand typically a move-up buyer or a first-time buyer or maybe even an immigrant?
It's, you've covered it all.
I've covered it all.
Yeah.
What would be the greatest percentage of, you think,
it will be
up?
The move-up buyers.
Okay. So they
and
have
the move-up buyers who have financial abilities.
Okay.
You have a lot of people who, and then you've got the, you know, when I say move up, you've got the move down. You had a lot of people in the mortgage business that was making a ton of money and buying a $2 million house, and now they are back in the real world, and they can only afford $1 million. So you've got some movement down that way.
The problem is who do they sell that $2 million house to, even in Orange County?
Well, fortunately, that market is still pretty strong out here.
Okay.
So that's working out real well.
You know, I was just going to mention, you know, probably the equivalent for us would be Corona, which had tract homes that were 4,500 square feet that went for $1.2 million. They're now you have REO listings in that neighborhood for $6.5 million.
I know. It's unbelievable what's happened there in the, you know, Riverside Corona area. It's just amazing about the price differentials now.
Do you think that it'll take a while for Orange County to go up again just because there's so much of a difference in price where maybe before there wasn't? So someone will go, okay, yeah, I'll go to Corona for that house. Where in Orange County, that would just be out of reach.
For them, yeah, that's true.
Okay.
You would see, well, two areas, though. You've got to look at jobs and employment growth and income. So Orange County, being a very affluent county, is obviously going to rebound before the Inland Empire.
Sure, that's its history.
But the buyers that can afford the Orange County properties certainly can go out there and pick up some properties. But I think, you know, the best thing to do is to look at Orange County rebound, and then we know probably a year to 18 months later, you know, the Corona Riverside market can start strengthening or stabilizing.
There's been an awful lot of attention and government assistance, or at least attempts at solving this, and I've been kind of surprised at how quick and how many of solutions there have been. So let's talk about some of the things that they've come up with and see what your reaction is as far as their impact. A freezing of the subprime rate changes, as far as the interest freezing, what do you think the effect that'll have on it?
Well, now, effect on hold the paper or the people that live in the house?
The market in general, the real estate market.
It's remember, we go back to the subprime. Those rates were so high that freezing them, the lenders could still be making money.
Correct.
As long as the people are paying. So that's a really good temporary fix. In the long term, though, lenders, it may make lenders a little bit shy about making certain types of loans. So like you said earlier, I think you're correct. We're probably going to get away from garbage lending for quite some time, because the lenders will have a memory of the fact that government came in and wanted to freeze some rates.
Well, in the year that I've been having this radio show, I've heard this term quite a number of times, unintended consequence. And so that's what you're saying, is that, okay, if I'm a lender and you've shown me that maybe you're going to freeze something that I thought I could change, then I won't do that program. What about in the same kind of sense, do you think a bankruptcy judge should be given the power to cram down the value of a loan for a lender, saying that the market value has changed, so now the value of your loan is permanently down here?
No, I'm absolutely against that.
Okay, I think that would be the same thing. I think we'd have lenders saying, well, I think I'll need about 30 or 40% down.
Yeah, you give judicial powers to that, you know, to that side, and you just, you know, the lenders will just go away.
I think so, too. What do you feel about the raising of the Fannie and Freddie loan limits and FHA as well?
Well, I think it, first of all, is long overdue.
Absolutely.
California's always struggled with the fact that, you know, the loan amounts, and that's why FHA in the state of California here, I think, is where it's 9%. For the nation, it's only 2%, FHA and VA, only 2% out here in California.
Yeah, we used to go to HUD auctions in downturns, and now they don't have enough loans. If they all went bad, we wouldn't go to one.
Yeah, exactly. So that's going to be very beneficial. We will see the first benefits in the refinancing market as people shore up some of their adjustable loans and loans that have been growing, you know, where they've been paying less than interest only, as long as they still got equity. But that's still quite a few people. And then we'll see that big boon first. And then as that shores up and then that stabilizes the market, then, of course, the buyers can come in here. And for Orange County, you know, which is my primary base, of course, it's a terrific benefit.
That would be. What is the difference in interest rate between a jumbo and a Fannie Mae rate?
Oh, you're looking at least 1.25% right now.
So if you're talking 700 grand, that's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money.
That probably represents $60,000 more house, I would assume, something like that.
Yeah,
okay.
It could work out that way.
I know you pay attention to other countries as well in some of the statistics that you look at. I was curious, did they have the same type of loan product? Did they end up with lax lending standards that helped their booms as well?
Well, They did change their lending standards, but it was nowhere as flexible and as easy as ours, which relates to an earlier statement you made about foreigners coming in and buying.
Mm-hmm.
In many countries, well, and your audience would be surprised that many countries, it's all just cash. There's no financing.
That's right.
Then the countries that do provide financing, it's normally you putting down half. Now, Australia and Great Britain broke away from that, I think right near the end of the last century and right during the new millennium, where they started offering programs where they would allow people to buy with 25% down and then 20% down and then 15%. But they were always more conservative than our nation was in terms of lending. And that's why we drew a lot of both immigrants and foreigners as investors in real estate.
What countries buy the most United States real estate?
That would be Great Britain right now. They represent about 12% of all our sales, the British.
Oh, wow. Of all sales?
No, 12% of the foreign. I'm sorry.
Oh, okay.
Thanks for correcting that.
I was going to say, wow.
12% of the foreigners buying is from just one country, and that's, of course, Great Britain. And it makes sense. In fact, we're seeing more foreigners come into the United States acquiring real estate, and they're betting on two things. Number one is that if you look at the pound, it is appreciated at least 12% against our dollar in the last year.
Sure, they get a double
yeah.
whammy.
So they're coming in and they're saying, my gosh, with the strength of our pound and the weakness of the dollar and these depressed prices, you know, we want to buy these things. So they're buying them for that. And then they're betting that, number one, that the U.S. dollar will not stay down, you know, for the long term.
Mm-hmm.
It'll get back up to its normal levels. So they're buying real estate cheap, and then they're betting against a low currency so that if and when they want to sell sometime in the future, if the property's gone back up and the U.S. dollar has strengthened, then they get a double bang for their buck.
You can see how that would be attractive. I know Canadians are also coming down into Palm Springs, although that market's still hurting, but Canadians are a pretty good buyer of Palm Springs anyway.
Exactly. With them, for the first time, the Canadian dollar being stronger than ours, yeah, they are moving down into that market.
Mm-hmm. Probably the last question we have in this segment is about the presidential election. Do you view this election important to the future of real estate?
Oh, that's, you know, I normally don't care who's president.
Okay.
They can wish and make all the things they want, but they've got to go through the old political drama, and it doesn't pretty much matter who's president or Republican, Democrat. Of course, we've never had an independent, but normally it just doesn't matter. In this market, though, because we've got such uncertainty in the financial markets,
mm-hmm.
Depending on who might be president, can either give them hope or say, "Oof, we've got, you know, if they get some of their programs through, we're going to have some more problems."
You know, what you're saying is that the way we marketed our paper this time and involved foreign countries in buying it, that for the short term, we have a credibility issue.
Correct.
And that's really what's causing a funding problem, is people are now skittish about funding our paper, certainly beyond what was 417.
Correct.
Yeah.
But the other good side to this is that we've had financial crises in the past.
Mm-hmm.
We went off the gold standard, the Bretton Woods issue. We've had the SNL failure. And the nice thing is that the financial markets, it usually takes about 6, 7, 8 months for them to recorrect themselves. So we've got the new programs in place. The lenders are, you know, many lenders are dropping their wholesale divisions. They're going to control the lending themselves rather than let mortgage brokers do it. They're going to establish new lines for qualifying and guidelines for buying property. And once they do that, then they have to write the software so that when the program's introduced and people call in, it fits into the computer system. And that all takes time. But the good news is within probably another 30, 60 days, most of these primary lenders will be back online with their programs, their policies, the computer software up, and ready to make loans again.
Well, Gary, we're out of time. I really appreciate you taking time. I know you're very busy on the speaking tour. It said I read something where you spoke to 17,000 real estate agents in the last year. So that's a lot of agents to talk to. We've covered sort of the world scenario. On our next segment, we're going to talk about California specific. So, Gary, thank you so much for joining us.
That'll be great, Bruce.
Okay.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.
Catch Bruce and the Norris Group team March 7th through 9th in Los Angeles as Bruce discusses California real estate market timing and then teaches his California-only essentials course live in combination with a full day of training by land trust expert Bill Gatton. Bruce will also be speaking March 8th at the Global Real Estate Investment Expo in San Francisco. For specific dates, times, and locations, visit www.thenorrisgroup.com or call 951-780-5856 today.